Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take these enormous stacks of research, I mean, really dense, specialized topics, and drill down to the nuggets of knowledge that matter. If you are serious about material science or, you know, just incredibly curious about how the stuff we build things with actually works, you're in the right place. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into the microscopic world of steel. And this isn't just any steel. We're looking at the structure that gives some high-performance alloys their incredible strength. We're tackling the famous metallurgical puzzle surrounding lower bainite.
That's right. When engineers talk about making stronger steel, you know, for everything from vehicle chassis to building supports, they're often chasing the properties delivered by the bainite transformation. But for decades, the process by which lower bainite forms, specifically the precise location and timing of the crucial carbide precipitation.
These are the tiny iron carbon compounds, right?
Exactly. The location of those has been a source of intense scientific disagreement.
And this isn't just, you know, academic quarreling. It's foundational. If you don't know exactly how a desirable structure is created, you can't really engineer it efficiently. We have source material here that promises to finally resolve this confusion, clarifying the nature and significance of carbide precipitation accompanying the lower bainite transformation in steels.
Our mission today is to resolve this long-standing mystery. We need to clearly establish the true role of lower bainite carbides, specifically distinguishing between cementite and the elusive epsilon carbide, and clarify the critical three-phase crystallography that defines the structure.
So you, the listener, are about to get a serious shortcut to being well-informed about a highly specialized area of metallurgy, and hopefully understand exactly why this highly desirable structure is so strong. Okay, let's start with the basics for anyone who doesn't spend their day looking at iron on an atomic level. When we talk about steel, we're talking about two major phases of iron atoms, austenite and ferrite. Can you quickly paint the picture of what happens during this transformation?
Absolutely. Think of austenite and ferrite as two different seating arrangements for iron atoms in a stadium. Austenite is the phase that forms at high temperatures. It's very carbon soluble.
Meaning carbon atoms can squeeze into the gaps.
Right. And ferrite is the phase we get at room temperature. It's much tighter and less carbon friendly. Lower bainite, or LB, forms when we cool the steel at a specific intermediate rate, usually between 250 and 500 degrees Celsius, depending on the alloy. It results in a microstructure that is an ultrafine, non-lamellar aggregate of ferrite and these tiny carbide particles.
And this structure is strong because it suppresses the formation of unwanted, weaker ferrite phases that might happen if you cool it more slowly.
Precisely. It locks everything in place in a very strong configuration.
Okay, that sets the stage. Now, the core disagreement that has, you know, split the metallurgy world for decades centers on the choreography of carbon atoms during this change. You have the large parent phase, austenite, transforming into the smaller, tighter ferrite phase. The question was, did the carbides, the cementite, form right there at the interface between the growing ferrite and the shrinking parent austenite? That was the interface precipitation theory.
Exactly. Researchers like Shackleton and Kelly, they had evidence suggesting that the carbon atoms were immediately rejected by the growing ferrite, piled up at the boundary, and formed cementite there. I mean, they were seeing carbides lined up at the boundary, and it seemed logical.
But then you have the competing idea.
Yeah.
The intraferrite precipitation model. Walk me through that one.
The intraferrite model suggests something quite different. It suggests that the ferrite forms first through a swift, almost mechanical-like action, trapping all the carbon inside it. This makes it super saturated.
So it's holding way more carbon than it should.
Way more. And only after the ferrite plate has finished growing does the trapped, supersaturated carbon precipitate out inside the ferrite plate as cementite. And researchers like Kalish and Cohen saw some conflicting evidence back in the 60s and 70s that suggested both possibilities were happening, which, you know, led to the confusion we are trying to resolve.
And the sources we're analyzing here are directly challenging those earlier views, especially the view that the precipitation of cementite is an immediate product of that interface reaction.
Yes, and they're also challenging the longstanding belief that the other common carbide, epsilon carbide, is involved in the primary transformation event. We're basically settling the score on the famous epsilon carbide sighting of 1968.
To do that, the research had to use an extremely clean and specific steel alloy, didn't it? To eliminate complicating variables.
Oh, absolutely. This is critical. The material recipe matters hugely. They used a high purity steel with 0.3 weight percent carbon, 3% nickel, and a bit of molybdenum and boron.
Why those specific alloying elements? What's the thinking there?
Well, high purity was to ensure they were only tracking the iron carbon reaction. no noise. The 3% nickel was key because nickel promotes the formation of the displacive structure. It helps form bainite without the interference of, say, perlite.
And the molybdenum and boron.
Those were there specifically to suppress the competitive formation of upper bainite or any unwanted side reactions that might confuse the observations.
So they basically created a steel that was forced to transform only into the lower bainite phase they wanted to study. They isolated the mechanism. And they held this material at 435 degrees Celsius for precise time periods, up to 30 minutes. So what did the detailed high-resolution observation actually reveal?
What the sophisticated microscopy revealed is, well, it's conclusive. And it resolves the decades-long debate. The cementite precipitates are found internally, appearing as tiny lenticular that's lens-shaped particles located strictly within the bainitic ferrite plate.
Which firmly supports the intraferrite precipitation mechanism.
Firmly.
Okay, for the listener, what does intraferrite mean practically? It implies a specific timing, sequence, right?
Exactly. It means the transformation is a two-stage process. Stage one is displacive growth of the ferrite. Think of displacive growth like a rapid mechanical shear. It's fast, the atoms move cooperatively, and there's no time for the carbon to diffuse out.
Okay, so it slams shut, trapping the carbon inside.
Right. This creates a ferrite plate that is stuffed full of excess carbon, making it supersaturated. Stage two is the precipitation, where the carbon then forms cementite inside that solid ferrite structure.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because the location isn't just internal, it's specific. The orientation is the smoking gun that proves the mechanical, displacive nature of the transformation.
It absolutely is. The cementite precipitates don't just form randomly. They follow a single, highly specific crystal orientation. It's known as the Bogariatsky orientation relationship.
For someone who hasn't looked at crystallography since college, how?
Mm-hmm.
How can we visualize that?
Think of it like a perfectly aligned parking job for atoms. It's about minimizing strain. When the carbon atoms inside the ferrite decide to form the cementite structure, they have to maintain a relationship with the surrounding ferrite lattice. The Bogariatsky orientation relationship dictates that specific crystallographic planes in the cementite must run parallel to specific planes in the ferrite.
So like one direction in the cementite crystal has to line up perfectly with a specific direction in the ferrite crystal.
Precisely. For instance, the 100 direction of the cementite must be parallel to the 011 direction of the ferrite. It's a very strict rule.
So if the cementite was forming randomly at a moving boundary, the interface theory, you would expect a messier alignment, wouldn't you?
A total mess. If it were a purely diffusive reaction happening at the interface, governed only by where the carbon piled up, you would see multiple random orientations, or at least structures that don't satisfy these tight crystallographic matching rules like the Kurdiumov-Sachs or Nishiyama-Wasserman relationships.
So they didn't see that?
No. The fact that only one three-phase variant is consistently present at any point is powerful evidence that the structure is governed by these mechanical strain-minimizing rules, and that's inherent to the interferrite model.
And the researchers also presented direct evidence refuting the interface model by looking at the interface itself. What did they find there?
Well, using detailed dark field imaging and high-resolution transmission electron microscopy, they found absolutely no evidence of cementite penetrating into the parent austenite, even at the interface boundary.
And that's key, isn't it? Because if it formed there, you'd expect to see it straddling the boundary.
You'd expect it to be poking into the austenite, yes. The absence of that is a huge piece of evidence.
So the absence of cementite at the interface confirms the overall transformation proceeds via displacive growth of the supersaturated ferrite first, followed by that internal single-variant precipitation.
That's the sequence. The initial precipitation of cementite isn't related to the overall shape deformation of the plate, but its specific Bogariatsky orientation minimizes the local strain energy. That's between the tiny carbide particle and the ferrite matrix, which is crucial for the structure's long-term stability and strength.
This clarity on cementite formation, it helps us solve the second great mystery, the epsilon carbide. Where does all that carbon go if the ferrite plate forms so quickly?
Ah, yes. The transformation process doesn't just create ferrite, it acts like a snowplow for carbon. Since the carbon can't escape fast enough through the displacive mechanism, it gets shunted and pushed into the surrounding untouched parent face. This creates substantial amounts of residual austenite.
It's a carbon trap. Walk me through what that looks like.
Okay, imagine the new ferrite plate growing quickly like a knife blade. On either side, you are left with extremely thin films of retained austenite. The source material observed them to be between 40 and 400 angstroms thick. So very, very thin.
And they're just packed with the leftover carbon.
Heavily enriched in carbon, sometimes up to 0.8 weight percent, which is, you know, three times the average carbon content of the original steel.
Wow. And that concentration is high enough to suppress its decomposition during the primary bainite reaction. But that carbon-rich residue can't stay there forever, can it?
No, it can't. And what's fascinating here is what happens next. This is the source of all that historical confusion. The decomposition of this highly carbon-enriched residual austenite is a secondary event. It happens later, diffusively.
Meaning the atoms move slowly over time?
Very slowly. The researchers noted that observations of new precipitates forming from this diffusional decomposition were only seen after holding the steel for 30 minutes in the experiment.
Okay, let's clearly distinguish this for the listener. Earlier metallurgists saw these secondary carbides, sometimes epsilon carbide, sometimes cementite, and mistakenly associated them with the primary reaction, the one that formed the strong bainite plate.
Exactly. This new analysis clarifies that the epsilon carbide sometimes observed is likely the result of the diffusional decomposition of that leftover carbon-rich austenite residue. It's not involved in the primary mechanism that creates the strong, shear-formed lower bainite structure. Epsilon carbide is a byproduct.
And cementite, forming internally, is the defining feature.
That's the one.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this work provides a beautiful, consistent thermodynamic explanation for why the upper to lower bainite transition temperature boundary exists where it does. Why does that boundary shift?
That transition temperature is rationalized based on the fundamental energy requirements of the system. Lower bainite, the strong stuff, only forms when the temperature is low enough for that internal high-strain Bagratyonsky precipitation to become energetically favorable. If the temperature is too high, the carbon escapes quickly, favoring the Messier interphase precipitation, which is characteristic of upper bainite.
And carbon content matters too, right?
It does. We also see in the data that the lower bainite start temperature decreases with increasing carbon content. That's because the driving force for the initial displacive transformation of the austenite decreases as the carbon content goes up. The whole system just gets more sluggish.
So we accomplished our mission. You now know that when you hear about lower bainite, the structure's defining strength comes from a two-step sequence. A displacive shear creates supersaturated ferrite, and then cementite forms inside it, following a precise crystallographic orientation that minimizes internal strain.
And we finally resolve the epsilon carbide mystery. It's a byproduct. It comes from the subsequent diffusional decomposition of the highly carbon-rich residual austenite that was left behind. This framework provides a consistent logical explanation for the lower bainite transformation. It really reconciles a lot of previously conflicting observations.
It's amazing. For decades, researchers were struggling because they mistook the secondary reaction, the breakdown of that residual austenite, for the primary defining feature of lower bainite. This clarity is crucial for engineers looking to control strength and aging.
Absolutely. Understanding the precise sequence displacive growth followed by internal precipitation clarifies the role of carbon supersaturation in the driving force. It provides a deeper understanding of how these microstructures develop over time and temperature. This allows us to predict much more accurately when these highly strong steels might age, soften, or, you know, fail.
So what does this all mean for the next generation of super strong steel? Given this new clarity, you now understand that the incredible strength of lower bainite isn't just about the phases present, but the sequence of their formation, particularly the creation of that carbon-rich residual austenite trap. Which leaves us with a final thought. How might material scientists intentionally manipulate the prolonged, slow decomposition of that highly carbon-enriched residual austenite? Perhaps using different alloying elements like copper or silicon to stabilize or destabilize that residue, to introduce desirable secondary phases for even better, more durable performance. What stands out to you?